Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Terrence Hayes. Hayes was born in Columbia, South Carolina in 1971 and educated at Coker College, where he studied painting and English. Hayes is the author of four collections of poetry, including most recently Lighthead, which won the National Book Award for Poetry. A review of Lighthead in the New York Times said, "Hayes' fourth book puts invincibility and restless wordplay at the service of strong emotions." In 2014, Hayes was named one of the 21 MacArthur Fellows and was recognized for reflecting on race, gender, and family in works that seamlessly encompass both the historical and the personal and subvert canonical forms. Here's Terrence Hayes in 2015 as part of Poetry Downtown at the Winningstad Theater. Opening for Hayes is Ashley Tolliver, who won an Oregon Literary Fellowship in 2015 and has also received a fellowship from Caveh Kanem. She's the author of the chapbook Ideal Machine, published by Poor Claudia Press.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you to Lit Arts for having me. And I'm so excited to see Terrence read. So I'm going to read a couple poems, a couple older poems, and then a couple from Ideal Machine. So this poem is called Standing on the Lawn Outside of Your House with a match and a gallon of gasoline. This morning in the cupboard, I found your last quarter inch of whiskey, settled amber in the mason jar. Same burn on the horizon the last Indian summer, you sat naked at the kitchen table, carving the nectarines free from their stones. When the cold math of winter arrived early that year, I thought the first fist you seamed into my cheekbone was to get to the proof, to the pit of the marriage. You asked, if somewhere we find the itch of the lumber, do we find compassion for the axe blade that splits it? I used to lie down inside my own stitches and let the dawn light farm their black to noon. Now I run like a ragged dog over the tight bow of their edges. It doesn't make any difference what angle I work my heart against them. I still don't know what kind of woman I am. But as the flame nears the fingers that trust the match, as close as the skin can stand it to singe, I call this the nerve to find out. Kinesis. Though all bird-like creatures fear the same distance, it is instinct that pulls them to standing. In the museum, their bodies like sea glass, an astonishment. The specialist says we can classify species by measuring height with our hands. All but the smallest flamingos must stand 8 palm lengths from the earth. Their legs are the width of paper clips. This kind of gauging is necessary. To a child, the globe is cross-hatched dark blue, and it is. Mathematics form a tent frame. In this way, a sunrise is one kind of blood oxidizing. Today, I read in the New York Times that Africa is splitting in two. Land is metastasizing, spilling open and sinking. Ethiopia is covered in holes. I say I'm speaking in present tense, but all scientists say we are watching the ocean growing at staggering speeds. Can we say this is a continent oceaning? Once, I heard a father tell his older daughter, "You are a clear pool where light plays." Though she had also been an island orbiting a large body. Is this a natural disaster? The thing we feared most in the fires was logic. We watched the flames leap from the field to the trees, to the house in succession. Though we found it familiar, close in its grammar, most of us stayed inside. Today, Oakland firefighters are made out of paper. They write birch-soaked memoirs. They have lungs like parachutes and spit up sap oil. Our urgency comes because we too are upright, a vertical people. We are possessed by our margins. I am thinking of the mother who drowned her three boys and why she stopped first to undress them. If she was perfecting a displacement of water, plumbing a violent kinesis. It was late on the pier where one witness remembered. I saw a woman sitting on a bench, gazing at the water, occasionally looking from side to side as if she was waiting for someone. So these next poems are from a small chapbook published by Poor Claudia here in Portland. They're all called Idea Machine. In future rites, I lay down on the operating table, glassy and overdue. The surgeons take role in choirs, hands like night swimmers, bad water below the sea. Under lightest implication, the body breaks through. Under lightest implication, the crocus pushed through peat as a gesture for belief. Hourglass and tool, meadow sharpened to blade. On the last day, the light, so easy to breathe. Hustle star weaving the darkness around. A little let on the line, and faces go under a long way. A lover is always on his way into the room, inside the mind. He wants to break the glass casing on the firm gray stump from the bulb. He wants to cut where the cells have listed something to do with his hands. He wants to find where what is burnished is buried, where the air snatches the light to hum against the light like a grass blade tucked between the thumbs, lunettes of dark against the bone. He wants to catch me between his thumbs, whisper this small, this egg-shaped, too rare and sublime to demolish. The body strung with ornaments, they cannot fly, they can only stand still. We walk the little halls of my body, pale stepping stones, charred mercury. Dear surgeon, let's say we try it. Put my tongue to cure it. Let you carve in. At night, the room fills with children, each one of them ours. They flame around in their gene pools. Live instruments tuned, shivering the glass. A little resonance, picture postcard. Hair behind the ear, just the same. Place is a curl, you can touch it. The intersection, a line, drawing back to intervene. Tissue and bone, a moan one makes. The hand that lifts to clavicle, one note pulled to crater. They can sing or forget to sing. Thank you guys so much.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
You know, the room to me is somewhere between a deathmatch space where we can fight, a cage, and a Zen garden inside some kind of red cube. So that's nice. I think both those things are appropriate. It's good to be here. It's really an honor to be with Ashley. She could have gone a little longer. Maybe I should be for like 7 minutes. That was a lot. Like, I'm going to be for 30 minutes. I don't think I'm going to have the same Wait. So I'll have to do something about that. All right, so I do have Lighthead here, and I guess it's out there, so I should read it. But what I really have is what's not out there, which is How to Be Drawn. And what I was thinking about on the way here was like the poems in here that I had not read yet. And either I have not read them, they could be bad though. You know? So I did find one, and I thought, oh, I'll try that. All right, so that just keeps me on my toes since I don't have anything like, you know, brand new for you. So let me read just like one or two from Lighthead. This is like, it gets me warmed up. So it's the first poem in the book, Lighthead's Guide to the Galaxy. There's a reference to Molly Bloom and Ulysses, where she has, it's a 29-page sentence, which I do love a sentence, as you'll see. I like a long sentence. So that was 29. It's probably grammatically incorrect. Do you know this sentence where she's like, yes, and yes, apples, yes, and walk across the table, yes. It's just, yes, yes, yes. So there's a reference to that. Muscadine. The last meeting I did was in Mississippi, and everybody knew what a muscadine was. And the conversation was, nobody above Virginia will know, and nobody west of Mississippi. So people, y'all know what the muscadine is?
Grapes,
yeah. Yeah, it's a grape. Is that in this poem? It's in another poem. It's not in this poem. That'll come up. What's in this poem, it's a similar thing, though, and it's just about terrain. The thing that came up with this poem was screet, scrate, and script, as opposed to street, straight, and strip. So that's a Georgia phenomenon, and so I also talked to them about that. So that's true, too, that I can say that about this poem. That it is something that people say, and in fact, John Lee Hooker says it, if you listen to him on his records. I'm going to go straight up the street. But I read it in Tennessee, and the guy didn't get it. Anyway, so that's what I should say to you. All right, let me read. I wasted all my time. Lighthead's Guide to the Galaxy. Ladies and gentlemen, ghosts and children of the state, I am here because I could never get the hang of time. This hour, for example, would be like all the others were it not for the rain falling through the roof. I'd better not be too explicit. My night is careless with itself, troublesome as a woman wearing no bra in winter. I believe everything is a metaphor for sex. Lovemaking mimics the act of departure. Moonlight drips from the leaves. You can spend your whole life doing no more than preparing for life and thinking, is this all there is? Thus, I'm here, where poets come to drink a dark, strong poison with tiny shards of ice, something to loosen my primate tongue and its syllables of debris. I know all words come from pre-existing words and divide until our pronouncements develop selves. The small dog barking in the darkness has something to say about the way we live. I'd rather have what my daddy calls scrimp. He says discreet and means the street just out of sight. Not what you see, but what you perceive, that's poetry. Not the noise, but its rhythm, an arrangement of derangements. I'll eat you to live, that's poetry. I wish I glowed like a brown-skinned pregnant woman. I wish I could weep the way my teacher did as he read us Molly Bloom's soliloquy of yes. When I kiss my wife, sometimes I taste her caution. But let's not talk about that. Maybe art's only purpose is to preserve the self. Sometimes I play a game in which my primitive craft fires upon an alien ship whose intention is the destruction of the earth. Other times, I fall in love with a word like somberness, or moonlight juicing naked branches. All species have a notion of emptiness, and yet the flowers don't quit opening. I'm carrying the whimper you can hear when the mouth is collapsed, the wisdom of monkeys. Ask a glass of water why it pities the rain. Ask the lunatic yard dog why it tolerates the leash. Brothers and sisters, when you spend your nights out on a limb, there's a chance you'll fall in your sleep. So what that means now is I should read the other poem since I read that one. So this poem is The Deer. And I typically hold it just a moment because it's doing what I like to do, which is like push a sentence as far as it can go. So I'll read a few of those kinds of poems, but this one sort of breaks the rule. So it is doing kind of like just a kind of, it wouldn't be a daily practice, but it's a practice when you aren't making any shots, so to speak. Like, I guess I'll write a long sentence. So I was doing that, and then I stopped. And you'll hear where it stops and sort of takes another turn. But this is the one with the muscadine in it, so that's what I should say about it. Otherwise, it's kind of a different poem than the other, and I don't think there's much else to say about it. Pataskala is a town, if you're driving from Pittsburgh to Columbus, you'll pass Zanesville, which is kind of interesting, and then Pataskala. And if you're a poet, he's like, I gotta put that in the poem. Pataskala is the name of the place. The Deer. Outside Pataskala, I saw the deer with the soft white belly. The deer with two eyes as blind as holes. I saw it leap from a bush beside the highway, as if a moment before it leapt, it had been a bush beside the highway. And I saw how, if I wished it, I could be the deer, a creature bony as a branch in spring. And when I closed my eyes, I found the scent of muscadine, the berry my mother plucked Sundays from the roadside, where fumes toughened its speckled skin and seeds slept suspended in a mucus thick as the sleep of an embryo. It is the ugliest berry along the road, but chewed, it reminded me of speed. And I saw, when I was the deer, that I didn't have to be a deer. I could become a machine with a woman inside it, moving at a speed that leaves a stain on the breeze and on the muscadine's flesh, which is almost meat, the sweet pulp a muscadine leaves when it's crushed in the teeth of a deer, or a mother for that matter, or her child, waiting with something like shame to be fed a berry uglier than shame, though it is not like this for the deer. It is not shame, because the deer is not human. It is only almost human when it looks on the road and leaps, covering at least 30 feet in a blink. The deer I cannot be, the dumb deer, dumb and foolish enough to ignore anything that runs but is not alive. A trafficking machine filled with a distracted mind and body, deadly and durable enough to deconstruct a deer when it leaps, I'm telling you, like someone being chased. I remember a friend told me how, when he was 8 or 9, a half-naked woman ran to the car crying her man was after her with a knife. But his mother locked the doors and sped away. Someone tell him his mother was not a coward. That's what he thinks. Tell him it was because he and his little brother were in the car that she would not let the troubled world inside. It was no one's fault. The mind separated from the body. I could almost see the holes of her eyes, the white fuzz on her tongue, the raised buds soft as a bed of pink seeds, the hole of a mouth stretched wide enough to hold a whole baby inside. I could almost see its eyes at the back of her throat. I could definitely hear its cries. So what I should have said was, do not ask me any questions about that at the end of the night, because I'll be like, I don't know what the mouth was doing there. Let's see, what else can I do here? So, those sentences, I do have a few of them. They do get me kind of, that's why I like it, because it just makes me kind of push through it, even though sometimes I think I might be going too fast for the listener, but there's something syntactically that I like about a long sentence.
You're listening to a talk by Terrence Hayes. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Hayes is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Now back to Terrence Hayes. He performed in Portland in 2015.
All right, so now, I mean, you know, I do like weird, if I talk enough about like the weirdness of poems, people think of it as a kind of insecurity, but it's not. Like, that's what I like in poems, the weirdness. But I don't know if you like weirdness, so I have to account for what you may not like. You know?
Keep it weird?
Okay, so this is one. Good. But that just means don't ask me any questions. I mean, you can ask me questions. Don't be like, what was going on with reconstruction? So this is the one. I'm putting it in the middle in case it doesn't work. If you say it works and clap, I won't believe you because, you know, you paid your money, so you're going to be like, I love it. If it was free, you'd be like, that wasn't that good. Reconstructed reconstruction. So I've never done it, and this has kept me on my toes all day. And it's an interview, so it's like a Q&A, but the questions aren't heard, only the responses. So I almost think of it, and that's going to get really meta, as a kind of unannounced persona poem. So it's like some dude is answering these questions about something that happened in his town, I think. That's probably why I've never read it, because I've never been quite sure how to, you know, the sound of a question not being asked. So let's see, reconstructed reconstruction. So I'll do this. Like, you can imagine you're on the phone and you can't hear the question being asked or something like that. And then I'm answering. It says A, but I'm not going to do that. The strange thing about the portraits was that sometimes from within the display case during my rounds as the night guardian, a part-time job, I could hear them singing to one another. It was noise, if you weren't listening carefully enough, but the kind of noise you find in the woods behind a farmhouse, the noise of hooves stumping a cowbell into a bed of dry leaves. Who knew so much genre could come from sticks and air? Your guess is as good as mine. It may have only been the courthouse basement where we keep our town's old photos and whatnot, was haunted by a tambourine player and a fiddler circa Whitman on the battlefield, a brother and sister named Quincy and Adelaide. Looking at them, there was no way of knowing whether they meant their expressions to be ironic or allegorical. The sister had a faint mustache and lovely white eyes. I don't think they were twins, but I'll concede you can do anything with makeup and lighting. And I don't even know for sure that their tune was called Quixotic Abolitions. Where'd you hear that? They had no children. But the woman couldn't have had her tubes tied. It was against her godship, and moreover, it was the Reconstruction era. I wouldn't say that. I've got manners. He had no chickens, and even less knowledge of you and me waiting down the road. His head was asymmetrical. His laughter made a strange pennies and a ten sound when it came from his body. But no. There was nothing written about the town's runner-ups and third stringers, Mr. and Mrs. Buford Wood, who witnessed 2-3 dozen lynchings between them, Isaiah Davies, the thrice-married banker who supposedly owned one of Abraham Lincoln's handkerchiefs, the boot-wearing widow, Martha Herman, Mr. and Mrs. Knott, who, being some manner of immigrant with no concept of the silent K, announced themselves as Knott. But that's why I'm giving them a shout-out here. You should look into their stories. He ain't in the photos I've seen, but yes, there was a field hand with enough muscle to muscle the land. I'm willing to bet he was blacker than you and me. Once or twice, the postman saw him down on his hands and knees in the field, not like someone praying or weeping, but someone waiting to be transformed back into a beast. Word was, he snapped and tied the couple up in the barn. Could be fieldwork inspired in him an inkling of revolutionary violence. No, I wouldn't say that. You seem to wrongly think that I think of him as a wrongdoer in this moral calculus. No, well, that's my point. Who knows? The future came dragging a blue carpet bag up the long, dusty road. In time, the night will be pregnant with stars, and I will be back working the earth. Anyway, you can see how what happened to them could be easily made into a song. I told you it was strange.
You're listening to a talk by Terrence Hayes. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and More with Hayes is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Now back to Terrence Hayes. He performed in Portland in 2015.
So what I will say in advance of your questions is, that is what I like. I mean, the relationship between that and a long sentence is, bewilderment to go to the introduction, enchantment, and just out of reach in terms of, like, what's explainable or not. But, you know, by the time this is a book and it's made rounds and I've talked about it, I'll have, like, some really smart thing to say about that poem. And that'll be fine, you know, but in the meantime, I like not having, you know, much to say. So this one is another sprawling sentence, How to Draw an Invisible Man. And I guess the only thing to say about it is it's the Invisible Man of Ralph Ellison. And I guess the scenario would be if you were a mortician and they brought Ralph Ellison's body in, what might happen. So how to draw an invisible man. And I'll try to read it slowly. No, I may not read it slowly. How to Draw an Invisible Man. And then, when Ralph Ellison's corpse burst open, I discovered his body had been hoarding all these years a luscious slush, a sludge of arterial words, the raw and unsaid pages with their plots and propositions, with their arcs of intention and babbling, with their mumbling streams and false starts and their love and misanthropic thrusts, tendons of syntax unraveled from his bones and intestinal cavities, the froth of singing, stinging, stinking ink, reams of script fraught with the demons, demagogues, and demigods of democracy, demographies of vague landscapes, passages describing muddy river bottoms and elaborate protagonists crawling through a foliage greener than money in America before America thought to release anyone from its dream, the waterlogged monologues, one who is unseen speaks, burst suddenly from Ralph Ellison's body, and because I mean to live transparently, I am here, bear with me, describing the contents, the fictions envisioned by Emerson and immigrants, the dogmas, aboriginal progeny, scholastic recriminations, dementia, jubilee, hubris in Ralph Ellison, Duke Ellington's shadow, a paragraph on the feathered headdress of Marcus Garvey. Some of it was pornography. Some of it alluded to Negroes who believe educating black kids means teaching them to help black people feel comfortable. Some of it outlined the perks of invisibility, how we are obliged to avoid the zoo, the farm animals. It had something to do with captivity, flayed in the clinical light, the notes printed on the underside of his flesh were reversed, but readable, mirrored in the metal of the medical table. I wanted to print it all properly in a posthumous book in the name of prosperity and proof the genius we believed he'd wasted had been waiting all these years for a simple death sentence to break free. Yeah. All right. Let me see if I find something slower to read. Go back to, I said I was going to read two from Lighthead, so let's see what else I can read you in here. Here's another one. So the story around this poem, Cocktails for Orpheus, it comes late in the book, and it's something like a kind of a sonnet. I mean, it's 14 lines, and it kind of is rhyming a little bit, but the rhyme is like, you know, hands and bound and mind, or liquid and made, so you wouldn't necessarily hear it. But I had written a bunch of poems that I thought I was going to send to a magazine, and at the end I had like a bunch of broken poems, so I just sort of stitched them together, and then I was like, okay, now I got four poems, and I sent them out, and of course that one was the one this magazine took, and then later they were like, well, you record it, and so my wife sees most of the stuff that I write and then send into the world, but she hadn't seen this poem, and so of course she was like, I'm going to come with you and hear you record it, I want to hear this poem, and I said, oh, I'm going to be in trouble. So I was like, don't ask me no questions. So it's called Cocktails with Orpheus. After dark, the bar full of women part of me loves, the part that stood naked outside the window of Miss Geneva, recent divorcee who owned a gun. Oh, Miss Geneva, where are you now? Orpheus says she did not perish. She was not turned to ash in the brutal light. She found a good job. She made good money. She had her own insurance and a house. She was a decent wife. I know decent lives in the word descent. The bar noise makes a kind of silence. When Orpheus hands me his sunglasses, I see how fire changes everything. In the mind, I am behind a woman whose skirt is hiked above her hips, as bound as touch permits, saying, "Don't forget me when I become the liquid out of which names are born, salt milk, milk sweet, and animal made. I want to be human above the body, uprooted and right, a fold of please released, but I am a black wound, what's left of the deed." I'm trying to balance between clarity and mystery here. So, but that's hard. Let's see, I did bring up one in the box. I don't know if this book is out there. Could there be anything in here that I might read for y'all? I'm just gonna need that. We got a couple more minutes here. Well, this was a long sentence too. But this one, again, it's sort of moving for a different reason. So again, if you were to look, nobody's written about this yet, so don't write about it if you're in the audience. But there is a story, you might even think, like, I wish somebody would maybe think about this. Like, why am I writing all these long sentence poems? If I talk about it and then somebody, in, you know, listening on the radio will be like, maybe I'm gonna investigate this with Terrence Hayes. So here's another one, and a different kind of motive than like How to Draw an Invisible Man. You'll see that it's a more narrative poem, but the motive is a kind of emotional one, like saying, I just need to sort of muscle through this one. And I feel like this is the most autobiographical. I don't have a problem with confession or autobiographical poems. It just depends on sort of the dice roll of the reading. So it so happens that this is like the first one that is pretty rooted in a real story, even though I just called the dude M instead of saying his name. He knows who he is. Talk. I guess I'll say, because I don't know, maybe it's not clear right up front. You know, the speaker's like about 14 on the middle school basketball team. That might be in here somewhere. I haven't read this one in a while. Talk. Talk like a nigger now, my white friend M said after my MLK and Ronald Reagan impersonations. The two of us alone and shirtless in the locker room. And if you're thinking my knuckles knocked a few times against his jaw or my fingers knotted at his throat, you're wrong, because I pretended I didn't hear him. And when he didn't ask it again, we slipped into our middle school uniforms, since it was November, the beginning of basketball season, and jogged out onto the court to play together in that vision all Americans wish for their children. And the point is, we slipped into our uniform harmony and spit out "Go Team," our hands stacked on and beneath the hands of our teammates. And that was as close as I have come to passing for one of the members of the Dream. My white friend thinking I was so far from that word that he could say it to me, which I guess he could, since I didn't let him taste the salt and iron in the blood. I didn't teach him what it's like to squint through a black eye. And if I had, I wonder if he would have, grown up to be the kind of white man who believes all blacks are thugs, or if he would have learned to bite his tongue or let his belly be filled by shame. But more importantly, would I be the kind of black man who believes silence is worth more than talk, or that it can be a kind of grace, though I'm not sure that's the kind of black man I've become. And in any case, M, wherever you are, I'd just like to say I heard it, but let it go, because I was afraid to lose our friendship, or afraid we'd lose the game, which we did anyway.
You're listening to a talk by Terrence Hayes. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Hayes is coming up. Thank you. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Now back to Terrence Hayes. He performed in Portland in 2015.
Here's a kind of regular poem. Barbarism. If I find it, you know what I was going to read? I should read that poem. I got enough time to read it. It's a regular poem too, but it's a big poem. So that'll really get us to the end here if I read this big poem. But I did have a regular poem. See, now I can't find it. It's like, there ain't but one or two in the book. And then we'll just see what happens. So either we'll do two or we'll do three more if I find this poem. Okay, let me see if I can find it real quick. Barbarism. Just for people who are like a little bit dizzy. I mean, I'm a little dizzy. So I need to settle down here myself. Let me get me some water here. Okay, barbarism. And what I would say, again, is like, what is the imprint of always trying to get a sentence to kind of stretch until it starts to sing, which is what I think of with this syntactical thing, is that you hope that some of that makes an impression on just other sentences. So that's mostly what this was. I mean, again, it is sort of, I say regular because it's sort of rooted around a very sort of basic thing of like trying to cut my, or cutting my father-in-law's hair. So once I'm looking at that as a kind of like tangible, regular thing for a subject of a poem, then I'm just sort of listening for what I can get the sort of statements to do. So it's called barbarism, but it's like barber. Barbarism. It was light and lusterless and somehow luckless, the hair I cut from the head of my father-in-law. It was pepper-blanched and wind-scuffed, thin as a blown bulb's filament. It stuck to the teeth of my clippers like a dark language. The static covering his mind stuck to my fingers. It mingled in half-hearted tufts with the dust. Because every barber's got a gift for mind reading in his touch, I could hear what he would not say. He'd sworn to never let his hair be cut again after his daughter passed away. I told him how my own boy, his grandchild, weeps when my clippers bite behind his ear. But I could not say how the blood there tastes. I almost showed him how I bow my own head to the razor in my hands, how a mirror is used to taper the nape. Science and religion come to the same conclusion. Someday, all the hair on the body will fall away. I'm certain he will only call on me for a few more years. The crown of his head is already smoother than any part of his face. It shines like the light in tiny bulbs of sweat before the sweat evaporates. So how are we doing here? Can I get this? How long will it take to read this poem? So the story around it, I guess, is... it was just in the news. I'm just going to read it to you because I think that information is delayed in the poem, so I won't say too much about it. So, but you can see, the book is called How to Be Drawn. I did How to Draw an Invisible Man. I'll read this one, How to Draw a Perfect Circle, and I guess I'll end with How to Be Drawn to Trouble. So these will be the last two. And this is a longer one. How to Draw a Perfect Circle. And I guess one of the sort of scenes for it is just like a blind contour drawing. If you had a few art classes, maybe you know what that is. It's where you are, you know, the teacher tells you to start drawing, never look at the paper, never lift it. It's almost like the sentence. It's the same premise except for it's drawing where you just sort of don't stop. If you pick the pen up, you're done. So you're just going to try to draw the whole figure in one continuous movement. But this is not one sentence. But that would have been cool. Let me revise it. How to Draw a Perfect Circle. I can imitate the spheres on the model's body, her head, her mouth, the chin she rests at the bend of her elbow, but nothing tells me how to make the pupil spiral from her gaze. Everything the eye sees enters a circle. The world is connected to a circle. Breath spools from the nostrils, and any love to be open becomes an O. The shape inside the circle is a circle. The egg falling outside the nest, the serpent circles, rests in the serpent's gaze the way my gaze rests on the model. In a blind contour drawing, the eye tracks the subject without observing what the hand is doing. Everything is connected by a line, curling and canceling itself like the shape of a snake swallowing its own decadent tail. Or a mind that means to destroy itself. A man circling a railway underpass before attacking a policeman. To draw the model's nipples, I have to let myself be carried away. I love all the parts of the body. There are as many curves as there are jewels of matrimony, as many worlds as there are teeth in the mouth of the future. The mute pearls a bride wears to her wedding. The sleeping ovaries like the heads of riders bunched in a tunnel. The doors of the subway car imitate an O opening and closing. In the blood, the O spirals its helix of defects, genetic shadows, but there are no instructions for identifying loved ones who go crazy. When one morning a black man stabs a black transit cop in the face and the cop, bleeding from his eye, kills the assailant, no one traveling to the subway sees it quickly enough to make a camera phone witness. The scene must be carried on the tongue. It must be carried on the news into the future where it will distract the eyes, working lines into paper. This is what blind contour drawing conjures in me. At the center of God looms an O. The devil believes justice is shaped like a zero. A militant helmet or war drum, a fist or a gun barrel, a barrel of ruined eggs or skulls. To lift anything from a field, the lifter bends like an O. The weight of the body lowered into a hole can make anyone say O. The onlookers, the mother, the brothers and sisters, omen begins with an O. When I looked into my past, I saw the boy I had not seen in years do a standing backflip so daring the onlookers called him crazy. I did not see a moon as white as an onion, but I saw a paper plate upon which the boy held a plastic knife and sopping meat. An assailant is a man with history. His mother struggles to cut an onion, preparing the meal to be delivered after the funeral. The onion is the best symbol of the O. Sliced, a volatile gas stings the slicer's eyes like a punishment, clouding them until they see what someone trapped beneath a lid of water sees, a soft-edged whirl, a blur of blooms holding a coffin afloat. The onion is pungent. Its scent infects the air with sadness. All the pallbearers smell it. The mourners watch each other. They watch the pastor's ambivalence. They wait for the doors to open. They wait for the appearance of the wounded one-eyed victim and his advocates, strangers who do not consider the assailant's funeral appeasement. Before that day, the officer had never fired his gun in the line of duty. He was chatting with a cab driver beneath the tracks when my cousin circled him holding a knife. The wound caused no brain damage, though his eyeball was severed. I am not sure how a man with no eye weeps. In the Odyssey, pink water descends the Cyclops' cratered face after Odysseus drives a burning log into it. Anyone could do it. Anyone could begin the day with his eyes and end it blind or deceased. Anyone could lose his mind or his vision. When I go crazy, I am afraid I will walk the streets naked. I am afraid I will shout every fucked up thing that troubles or enchants me. I will try to murder or make love to everybody before the police handcuff or murder me. Though the bullet exits a perfect hole, it does not leave perfect holes in the body. A wound is a cell and portal. Without it, the blood runs with no exit. It is possible to draw handcuffs using loops shaped like the symbol for infinity from the Latin infinitus, meaning unboundedness. The way you get to anything is context. In a blind contour, It is not possible to give your subject a disconnected gaze. Separated from the hand, the artist's eye begins its own journey. It could have been the same for the Cyclops, a giant whose gouged eye socket was so large a whole onion could fit into it. Separated from the body, the eye begins its own journey. The world comes full circle. The hours, the harvest. When the part of the body that holds the soul is finally decomposed, it becomes a circle. A hole that holds everything. Blemish, cell, womb, parts of the body no one can see. I watch the model pull a button loose on her jeans and step out of them as one might out of a hole in a blue valley, a sea. I found myself in the dark. I found myself entering her body like a delicate shell or soft pill, like this curved thumb of mine against her lips. You must look without looking to make the perfect circle. The line, the mind must be a blind, continuous liquid until the drawing is complete. I'm gonna stop there.
That was Terrence Hayes speaking in 2015 as part of Poetry Downtown at the Winningstad Theater. You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, and the Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.